I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. John Updike is widely thought to be one of the great writers of his time. He's perhaps best known for the Rabbit books that follow an American man and his country over the course of five decades. Updike's output was prodigious. He was a novelist, poet, essayist, memoirist, and critic. Adam Begley's new biography, Updike, follows the writer from his birth in blue-collar Pennsylvania to Harvard, The New Yorker, and his long-running career as a man of letters. The book is published by HarperCollins, and I'm so glad it brings Adam Begley to the show today. Adam, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
So there was a personal connection here. Your father was at Harvard with Updike. And you met Updike, I guess, when you were just a little baby. Is that the way the legend goes, the origin story?
There's a family legend that I was sitting in a sort of baby contraption when I was really tiny, and next to me was a bowl of fruit, and Updike wandered into the room and saw me and saw the fruit, picked up three oranges and started to juggle. And I started to laugh, and apparently, according to the family, this was the first time I ever laughed.
Well, it tells something about Updike in a way, in that he was a little bit addicted to entertaining and diverting people. So maybe this was a very telling encounter you had with him.
He was a performer. He was a professional. He loved to make people laugh and to engage their interest, which he managed to do on the page fairly frequently.
Now, this book is interesting in contrast to some other literary biographies of people in kind of a similar literary class. Like, I mean, John Cheever is somebody always is compared to Updike, and vice versa. But when Blake Bailey wrote his John Cheever biography a few years ago, he had a lot of great stuff to work with, like alcoholism and closeted sexuality and stuff like that. And you, with John Updike, you're dealing with a guy who, as you said, presented a very kind of tranquil, calm surface. Was it a challenge to get beneath that surface and find the good stuff?
Well, libraries help, letters especially. Updike had a pretty easy path to literary stardom, but he did have some obstacles to overcome, nothing like Cheever's alcoholism.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the obstacles as you see them?
He had a stutter that manifested itself when he was about 15, and that he thought was in some ways debilitating. When you met him, probably you never noticed that he had this stutter, but it did change the way he talked, and you would see him visibly suppressing it as he was speaking. Mm-hmm. And then he also had, starting when he was about 5 or 6 years old, a terrible case of psoriasis that endured for most of his life. And he thought it deformed him and made him scabby and horrible. Again, if other people met him, they wouldn't necessarily notice it or see maybe a little flaking around the scalp. But he thought that these were things that he had to overcome to make it as a normal human being in the world.
I thought the story you tell about his mother, his mother's a great character, period, but The story of her basically being told of his birth in sort of an annunciation scene. try to tell us what happened, and because that struck me as so weird and bizarre. It was hard to see the rest of his life as being normal after reading that.
This is Linda Grace Hoyer, John Updike's mother, who, with John's help, began in the 60s to publish stories in The New Yorker that were really the memoirs. The character would be called Linda. And in one of them, she explains, and I think that she partly believes this, that she married her husband, Wesley Updike, essentially to create a child, because a voice had come to her and said, if you marry George, you will have an extraordinary child. I think that John was a little embarrassed by this mythology that she created about his birth, but it did mean that he was always the chosen one, and that he was going to fly, as all Updike mothers tell all Updike children.
And he had a tremendous sense of confidence from the get-go, and his path did seem pretty assured from the get-go. He grew up in blue-collar Pennsylvania, and he wound up going to Harvard. What was his his trajectory like at Harvard?
Well, he arrived at Harvard homesick and hypochondriacal and a little bit intimidated by the very bright people around him. He didn't yet realize that he was probably brighter than 99% of them. But it took him about a year until he got his wardrobe sorted out and began to look like the rest of them and realized he fit in and that he was going to do well. It helped to get on to the Harvard Lampoon, which I believe you're familiar with that institution.
I had a little run-in with them, yeah.
Yeah. He joined the Lampoon, which had been really part of his program from the beginning because he wanted to be a cartoonist. And he thought that cartooning for the Lampoon was his ticket to becoming, say, the next Walt Disney. I guess it worked for some of your colleagues.
Well, and he also was writing light verse, which isn't sort of a staple of the Lampoon now, but it was back in the 50s.
Yeah, a friend of mine once referred to it as tuning harpsichords. It's not really a skill that's much in demand anymore. He could churn out light verse without any sweat whatsoever, and the Lampoon needed to be filled every month or so, and Updike managed to do the drawing, write the light verse, and spin out stories. He was a triple threat for you guys.
And then he wound up graduating from the Lampoon and going on to the New Yorker. And there was an interesting comment in your book where he said that people assumed he just had this gilded path, this shoot from the Lampoon to the New Yorker. But he said that he had been already trying to get published in the New Yorker for 8 years or something like that.
Yes, that's right. He makes it sound a little worse than it was. But Updike had, from the age 13, been sending line drawings into the New Yorker, and they were regularly returned. And then when he was about 14 maybe, he started sending them light verse, and that also always returned. And then at Harvard, he started sending in short stories, also rejected. Though one of the stories he sent in his senior year, he later modified, changing very few words, and it was accepted as his second story ever in the New Yorker, and called Ace in the Hole.
Mm-hmm. What was that story about?
That story was about a former high school basketball champion who's fallen on hard times. If that sounds familiar, it's the same background of Rabbit,
sure.
Harry Angstrom. Ace in the Hole was a short, sweet, sharp story with a sort of Hemingway reverb. And it was the second story published in the New Yorker by him.
Mm-hmm. And then he landed at the New Yorker and really was the golden boy right off the bat. What was his life like there?
They installed Updike on the 18th floor, gave him a typewriter, and told him to go. And he started writing Talk of the Town pieces. And very immediately, it was obvious that he was writing them better than anyone who had ever done it. He didn't need to be rewritten. He was simply the best. Every single talk story he wrote for The New Yorker was published. In other words, not a single rejection.
Hmm. That's not usually the way they play over there.
No.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. I'm talking to Adam Begley about his new biography, Updike, of course, about the career and life of John Updike. It's published by HarperCollins. I thought it was interesting, given that he had such a golden path at the New Yorker, that he decided to turn his back on it and get out of New York and make a change in his life. What was the motivating factor behind that?
To put it in its simplest terms, Updike always wanted to be a big fish in a small pond.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with New York is, as somebody once said to him, somebody else is always making a louder noise somewhere nearby. The other thing is Updike, as we've said before, was an only child, and he wanted to be a solo act.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of being part of corporate excellence, which is what The New Yorker presented. You know, in those days, the Talk of the Town pieces weren't credited.
They weren't signed, right?
Exactly. So he was doing all this brilliant work, but it wasn't promoting John Updike, was it? So he took a very daring step, which is to go freelance. His plan was to move to Ipswich, Massachusetts, and publish six stories a year.
How did he settle on Ipswich?
He had gone there for a honeymoon weekend with his wife, whom he married at Harvard, Mary Pennington, as was Mary Updike. And he enjoyed it. He also liked the idea of baking himself on the beach because he thought it would cure his psoriasis, mm-hmm. which in fact it did.
Mm-hmm. And he wrote Couples, is really, I wouldn't call it dirty, but kind of racy book about adultery and stuff like that in Massachusetts, which kind of caused a sensation at the time. Did that create any problems in his life, in that he was writing a lot about people doing things and they were all real people doing real things?
You know, it's amazing how easily he got away with that. He did scramble the characters. He scrambled the characters when he wrote the first draft. Updike's first draft of Couples, you could tell who was who among his friends, his set of bed-hopping friends. And the Knopf took one look at this manuscript and said that you need to scramble further. So there was a hurried moving around of people. And so it was pretty disguised, but every single person in Ipswich played the game of who's who for about a year after the book came out. And it did create quite a sensation. It was on the cover of Time magazine under the banner headline, The Adulterous Society.
And how much later after he wrote that book did he decide he had had enough of Ipswich, or had Ipswich had enough of him?
Well, sadly, it was when his marriage to Mary broke up in 1974 that he left Ipswich. Though he never really left Ipswich, just as he never really left Pennsylvania, because he would revisit these places in his fiction. He was a great he was the great artist of nostalgia, and he was nostalgic for Ipswich about 10 seconds after he left it.
You know, you say he used this stuff. One thing that comes out in your book and emerges is almost a sense of Updike as being kind of a spy. He's got this really presentable exterior, and he mixes very well, and he mingles well, but all the while he's taking down notes and figuring out, how am I going to turn this into a New Yorker story? And you have a great anecdote at the beginning of a writer trying to do a profile of Updike and then finding out that Updike is using the material to write a story about him. Can you walk us through that?
Well, you know, Updike was a tremendous observer. He watched everything that was going on very, very closely. But you wouldn't necessarily see him observing because he was so busy being charming. If you met Updike, he would smile at you. The smile would be slightly wicked and endearing. And you would fall for it, and you would fail to notice that he was observing with intent, by which I mean that if you did anything even remotely interesting or that fit into the fictional workings going on in his brain, you would show up in his fiction the next week in The New Yorker, or perhaps the next year in a novel.
There's also a funny story you mentioned in the beginning of the book where he's at doing a college date. He's doing a well-paid college date, and he's at the president's house, and some very nice Midwestern woman said, Mr. Updike, are you the man who wrote that wonderful story about the man who swims from pool to pool? And she's got him mixed up with the other John. But those two are often linked, even though they're very different ages. John Cheever was considerably older, but they're both New Yorker fiction writers. They'd write about suburbia. How did Updike feel about Cheever? How did he feel about the comparisons to Cheever?
It's interesting. John was generally competitive with other male writers. He never felt competitive towards Cheever for the simple reason that Cheever was 20 years older, mm-hmm. a whole generation older. The scary and sad thing is that Cheever felt competitive towards Updike. So though they were friendly and, for example, spent time in Russia together under the auspices of the State Department, being American authors abroad, John Updike thought they were great pals. John Cheever was writing poisonous things about Updike in his journals. And when John Updike found out about this, he was very hurt, but quite mild in his response, and realized that, as he said, the literary life is like Medusa's raft, and your reaction when you see someone trying to clamber aboard is to stomp on their fingers.
Mm. Who did he feel competitive with?
Who didn't he? The question.
Well, who did he have the most poisonous feelings towards?
it emerged, I think, later on that he wasn't as entirely comfortable with his friendship with Philip Roth as Philip Roth was. And
when you say it emerged, how did that
Well, happen? He and Philip Roth were great pals, and they wrote they didn't see each other very often, but they wrote each other hysterically funny letters and were charming with each other when they met. For example, my favorite little line is sadly not in the book. I don't know what happened. When Updike sent his autobiographical poem Midpoint to Philip Roth, he crossed the title out and said, called it Poor Goy's Complaint. but when Updike eventually started writing reviews of Roth's books that were less and less friendly, and eventually made some rather borderline slanderous remarks about Updike in the New York Review, about Roth in the New York Review of Books, which ended their friendship permanently.
Did it cause Roth to have a breakdown, or is that urban legend?
That's, according to Mr. Roth, urban legend. It was a claim made by his ex-wife, Claire Bloom.
Oh, so we know. Yeah, so we can't tell.
When I put it to Mr. Roth, he denied it firmly.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll let him have the last word on that. You know, Philip Roth's career and his reputation have continued to ascend in the last decades of his. He says he's through with writing now, but who knows? That didn't happen with Updike. Updike suffered in terms of the critical assessment of his work in the last decades of his writing life. Why do you think that is the case?
I'm not really sure. I think, well, part of it is that there was a run of novels that sometimes weren't as good as his early work. There may be a question of simple overload. Updike wrote 60 books. He wrote more than 20 novels. I think people thought after a while that they could greet an Updike new novel with a shrug.
Right.
I think that this will change. I think that there will be a surge in his reputation.
All right. Well, this book may start that. We'll see. I've been speaking with Adam Begley about his book, Updike. It's in your stores now. Adam, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you, Andy, for having me.